thing that you have to ask seems a little or a little bit foolish. That doesn't matter. We all ask. The thing that has you have noticed. How long have you been here? You came each come today?
Yeah.
Have you seen people riding in carriages since you were here?
Well, we've seen people riding on horses.
With horses?
Yeah, about three of them. Remember at the
Well, that's something else.
Well, I wondered if you saw people riding.
No, we haven't.
Riding.
Been,
you haven't seen
we've
it.
We've been on this side of on the east side of Morgantown.
Where you two hope
yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, tomorrow you will. And some of the things you'll see tomorrow, I want to help you to understand a little today before you go out, if I can. Because many of the things that the people do hear about, they are connected to their religious beliefs or something that they hold because of the religion they have. Now, as he was telling you, this country around here, much of Lancaster County, was settled with people of Swiss and German background. And the Swiss people who came here were German-speaking Swiss. If you know something about the Swiss, their country is divided and speak various languages. But the Swiss who came here were German-speaking Swiss. Mr. Celsius will tell you that right here, this particular neighborhood was first settled by a Welsh, wasn't it, Mose? And you can tell by the names of the, have you noticed the names of the places that you came through? Carnarvon, for instance?
Yeah.
Carnarvon is not a German name.
Elverston?
Yeah, some of these names are Welsh names, and this is interesting to us because there were Welsh people who lived in this area, and there were mines. But in time, it became more of a farming community, and then the German and Swiss people moved up this way from Lancaster County until now. In this area, as you drive toward New Holland, you'll see many, many Amish farms and Mennonite farms. An Amish farm you can usually tell because it will often have a windmill. The Amish people, I will tell you something more about them later, don't have electricity on their farms. I'm just telling you this so you understand what you see tomorrow. Now I'm going to go back and tell you how that happened that caused these people to believe some of the things that they do. I'm not going to go back as far as I sometimes do, but I will go back to the time of the Reformation. And in the Reformation, you studied history, you know about how far have you studied history?
They're going to be studying the Reformation this year. They haven't studied it yet.
Well, you come to the Reformation, you'll know something about some of the people who came out of the Reformation. In the beginning, if you read your Bible, in the book of Acts, you read about the beginning of the Christian religion when there was only a small group of people who were Christians. After Jesus Christ went back to heaven, that's what all of those of you are believe. I'm not here to tell you what to believe. I'm just telling you how to believe. And they, these 120 people were not a very large group. And they were not looked upon with much favor in the places they lived. As time went on, their group grew larger, but they were still very much persecuted by all the people of other religions. And for a long time, to be a Christian was not a very popular thing for about three centuries. Then after that, Christianity became a state religion. And then instead of being a persecuted religion, one needed to be a Christian, or to profess Christianity at least, almost to survive in the countries in which, in the European countries especially. When any religion becomes a state religion, no matter what it is, then it often becomes something that people do lip service to, and not all of the people. Some of the people will be devout and some won't. And then there will always be people who will ask questions. And so this is what brought on the Reformation. There were people who asked questions about this. Should there be a state religion? Should we all, is this what the Bible means? And they began to read their Bibles and to ask questions. And so we have Martin Luther, who is one of the people who began to ask many questions. But there were other people about this time who asked questions, and two of these men were named Felix Mann and Conrad Grebel. And you probably never heard of these two men, but they were two people who also were reading the Bible and asking questions about this time, and they lived in Switzerland. And they were the founders of what is known as the Mennonite Church. And the Amish are part of the Mennonite Church. They are a branch. of the Mennonite Church. It seems funny that these two men who began this movement or who gathered these people together didn't have their name, but they didn't stop. They never really wanted to be called Mennonites. That was the name people gave them because later on they had a strong leader by that name. They called themselves the Swiss Brethren, and they were more anxious to be known just as brethren who wanted to read the Bible and believe what it said. And this was the beginning, and one of the things they held very strongly to was the fact that the state couldn't tell you what your religion should be. They felt that the state didn't have the right to tell you this, that each man should of his own free will choose how he would worship God. They lived in Switzerland at a time when the state religion was a reformed religion. And yet there were many people they knew who lived in this state who had once been Catholic and perhaps would have preferred to be Catholic. But because this was a reformed state, they must be reformed. If they were very devout Catholic, perhaps they crossed over into another state where the Catholic religion was the state religion. But each state has religion, and to this church you must go. And these Swiss brethren wanted to go to neither of these churches. They wanted to have a free group of their own. And yet they didn't feel that these other people shouldn't have their church too. They felt they should. It was a very dangerous thing to say things like this. It was so dangerous that these two men, one was put into prison and treated so badly that he died, and the other one was drowned by the authorities because he believed this. There were many other things that they felt. They felt that when they read the Bible, what Jesus had to say, that people should live simply, that they should love each other, that they should love people even who didn't love them. They tried to carry this into their life and into their living and into their belief. They believed that people should dress simply and that their home should be simple and that they should not spend too much time thinking about these things. I'm not going to say now that Mennonites have always been able to carry out the things that they believe, but this is part of the basic belief that they carry. And especially that there should be equality among the people, that they should love each other and care for each other. And they didn't believe in taking up arms. And this also was very unpopular. It's unpopular today, as you know. But this they have held to through these. This was in 1537, and this they have held to through these years, when it was popular and when it was unpopular. They have still held to this belief, basing it on the things that they read in the Bible. Now, one of their strong leaders was a man named Menasinus. This was in a time when they were very much persecuted. They were often put into prison. Sometimes they were killed because, as I said before, unless you would subscribe to the state church, whatever that church might be, you were under censure. And at a time when they were very discouraged because so many of them had been in prison for no other reason than the fact that they wanted to worship and they believed they must worship like the Bible, they felt the Bible taught, they must hold to this. And rather than give it up, well, they would accept death or near prison. I sometimes said when I read the history of the church, we have a big book called The Martyr's Mirror. I think there's one here somewhere. In this book is a record of all these men who were one after the other, and women too, for one reason or another, imprisoned or killed. Sometimes they were burned. It's a very awful thing to tell, but this is what did happen. And this book is found in most Mennonite homes. And when I finished listening to it, I have never been able to read it from cover to cover, but I have read parts of it. I have not been so surprised that there are as few Mennonites as there are. I have wondered that there are as many as there are. So many of them at that time were put to death. And this man, Menasinus, gathered them together when they were very much discouraged and very much persecuted. He strengthened them and he managed get the various groups who didn't know each other very well to work together. And so people began to call the Mennonites after him, and that's where we got the name. Not because he was the founder or even because he wanted his name attached to us, but we still have it. In 1693, there was one of the leaders of this church who disagreed with the others. His name was Amish. From him, the Amish get their name. Anybody tells you their name's Amish, it's not. It's Amish. He felt that when anyone had been a member of their group and left their group, and this happens to all groups, then he thought that you should shun this person. Now, this seems like a contradiction to most of us, because if we are to love everybody, even those who don't love us, why should this be carried out? But he was very strong about this, and he felt in other ways that the general Mennonites were too worldly in certain areas, and so there was a disagreement, and one group of people were the Amish people. This happened in Germany, or in the other, before they came to this country. Now, as the years went by, and America was opened up to colonists, William Penn, who was a Quaker, invited the Mennonites and the Amish to come here to settle. He knew how persecuted they were, and there are many things that the Quakers and the Mennonites, do you know something about Quakers? You a Quaker? All right, we owe a lot to the Quakers. So they were the ones who invited us to come to this country. And there are things that the Mennonites and the Quakers share. Their belief about war is one. And in those days, a Quaker was a man who, you see pictures of William Penn, who wore a broad-brimmed hat. Mennonites looked something like that too, and you'll see some too. You'll see some broad-brimmed hats still left in Lancaster County before you get away from here. Some haven't yet. There were things that they shared in their feelings, and he invited them to come here. And many, many of them came. They came in about, before 1700, they began to come. I think from 1683 to 1703, I found the dates, was the largest immigration. They came from Germany, and they came from Switzerland. Albert has been leading some tours around the county, and she learned some pictures that we often do. They keep telling her, so much of this is Swiss, so much of this is Swiss. I thought these people were German. Well, many of them were Germans speaking Swiss, and there are certain things that you're going to see when you go around the county that will tell you that these people did have a Swiss background. Did you see Mr. Stolzfus's barn out here yet? Well, did you notice that around on the other side he has a bank that you could drive up into the... Could you guess that the bank barn might come from a hilly country where the banks were natural? They tell us this is a Swiss barn. I've never been to Switzerland. This is where we get the idea that a Swiss barn will have this. And I've never been there, but these are some things that people tell us who know the Swiss. I know some of my own background is Swiss. So there are things they brought with them to this country like this that tell us where they came from. But they came, many, many of them came. The first place that they settled was near Philadelphia, and it's still called Germantown. The oldest Mennonite church in the United States is in Germantown. And from there they came, spread out through Lancaster County. They came out into the wilderness and worked and carved out farms and homes, just as other immigrants doing in other parts of the country. Not only Mennonites came, though, although many of the first ones came were, because they were the persecuted people. And you know, the United States was settled first nearly all by people who were the persecuted people, who were glad to find a haven and a place to go. And the Amish came, too, and almost everywhere where the Mennonites live, you will find Amish. Not everywhere, because there are many Mennonites who live in cities, and you just almost never find an Amish person who lives in a city. I'll tell you about that then. We share many beliefs, basic beliefs, but in our way of practicing, you'll find great differences. For instance, I wanted to try to explain a little bit the difference between the Mennonites and Amish. Now, we share our beliefs like this. We believe in many things that all Protestant churches believe in, some things all Catholic people believe. We believe in the Trinity, for instance, and many things like that that you will find in all basic Christian churches. But we do have our belief about participating in war, and our belief that you should live simply and that you should be somewhat separate from many things in the world, that you should think things through before you accept them. And because of this, we are slower than some people to accept everything that comes along. For instance, certain entertainments, we would be very slow to accept. But the Amish look at things somewhat differently. We have electricity here. We believe as Mennonites, electricity is good, automobiles are good, but be very careful how you use them, so you use them in a right way. After all, in itself, there's nothing evil about electricity or about an automobile or anything, but you might be able to use it one way or another. You could say that about books and almost anything. But the Amishman takes a long look at it, and he thinks, my fathers, who were very careful about accepting anything new, didn't have this, they got along without it, I can too. Maybe it's something of the world that I had better not have. And so he won't have that in his home. And as time goes on, they do use some things more than they did, but they're very slow to use it. And so you still see their horses, they still don't have automobiles, you'll see their horses and carriages tomorrow on the road. They have, it makes it very difficult for them to know just where to draw the line, but that's true of all of us, I suppose. They will perhaps have, they have rubber tires on one thing and on the other they won't. You know, they're very slow to accept tractors or anything like that. They won't have electricity. Someone told me recently that they think maybe they don't really realize. They said, you know, they knew an Amishman in the long ago when they first had some of these things, and he said, if we have electricity, somebody must work on Sunday to produce the power. So we can do without it, but make somebody work on Sunday. And this was some of the basis for some of it. You see, they were really trying to think it through. They didn't work on Sunday. Why should I make someone else work on Sunday? But then when they use public transportation, I don't know where you draw the line, where they draw the line. But this is the thinking that makes them slow to accept anything new. Some people pity them. Well, there's something else I wanted to tell you that's a difference too. It's the same way with education. A Mennonite, there are some Mennonites who don't care much for education, but on the whole they do. We have high schools of our own. We have many of our children who attend public high schools, who go to college. Some of them are doctors, some of them are lawyers. But an Amish person expects to be either a farmer or to have some kind of a job that's something like he might be a carriage maker, or he might be a carpenter. What else does he do? He might be a miller or a stonemason, but he would not have a profession. They make very nice chairs, tables. We have a very nice table that was made by one. They do things like that. They will make furniture for in the house, something that has to do with a farm or a farm home. But beyond that, they will not go. If they need a doctor, they will expect to get a doctor from some other person. They will have a doctor, by the way. Some people think they don't, but they do. Because of this, they don't see why any of their children should be required to go to school after the eighth grade. So the end of the eighth grade, he can figure well enough to do his income tax, I suppose. He can write, he can read, he's old enough to help with the farm work. Why should he go to school after the eighth grade? And so if you've ever, it hasn't been in the papers much lately, but some of your first classes came at a time when it was very much in the papers. And they understood this problem before they ever got here, having read quite a bit in the papers. They have come to some agreement with the school boards now. They have some of their own schools. And after the eighth grade, they have a system that they may report to a teacher for ever so often. They study summers and pick some spelling, some German. And beside that, they must do something, some kind of a vocational project on the farm that they are given credit for. But they hold out very much against any kind of formal education beyond the eighth grade. They still do. Now, I don't know if you'll believe, but this is an Amish school while they're here. Not an Amish school. They still hold out. They do. On the other hand, one of my friends who taught an all-Amish school told me, she said, but these children, when they're getting here to eighth grade, they're anxious to get to work on the farm. Now, this isn't true of everyone. There are some who would naturally resent this, but there are others. This is their life. These are their friends. This is what we're all going to do. They have a very close-knit family life, and they have large families on the whole. Not always, but many of them have large families. And they're used to giving and taking, and they're used to all helping. They all know how to work. I was at an Amish funeral one time, and I was there. They have an all-day funeral there. I've never been to many of their services. Another thing I wanted to tell you is the Mennonites have churches. They have church buildings. They have rather plain buildings. And if you see inside one, you will see that there isn't much ornamentation. But the Amish people don't have a church. They meet to worship in their homes. They often use their barns in nice weather. And many of their houses have petitions that can be moved aside. And then someone said, well, what do they do if the group gets too large? Well, that's very simple. They make another group. The group is only to be so large. Then we'll have another group. So there's no problem. We'll just use somebody else's house, see? So when a group gets too large, then there's another group. And they meet together generally, I think, on all the Sundays. And all of their, they still keep their German language. That's another thing. We poor Mennonites wish some of us, wish we did know it. We don't even know Pennsylvania Dutch anymore, a good many of us. But an Amishman can talk Pennsylvania Dutch. And he understands some German because the preaching is done in German.
So by the way, we will visit an Amish farm where we will see where they worship and see the benches and all the things they have.
They are used to working together. This I do admire. My neighbor died, and she was an Amish lady, and I asked the girls if I can come over and help today at the funeral, and they said, yes, come in the morning and bring your peeling knife. So I did. I went early in the morning, and I have never seen so many women peel potatoes so fast without getting in each other's way. I'm sure that none of us could have done it in the same way. They are used to doing this. They are used to working together and doing things together. They stand by each other. If one of them has a misfortune, they will all help each other. There are things about them that we want to admire. Do admire, and anything that they have in the way of a, what shall I say, social gathering, on the whole, I don't think they'd ever send out invitations for a party unless it was a wedding, would you? But if there's a sale, and they're all there, why, that's sort of a party. If they want a quilt, they have a quilting, and that's kind of a party for the women, and if they have a barn raising, somebody's barn needs to be put up or something. Well, that's anything they do. As Mr. Studer told a group here before one time, it's very much like early America. Did you read about the pioneers? That's sort of the way they had. Well, they still do quite a bit the way they people did long ago. They have. I don't know. I sort of lost my notes here. I've talked this so often, I don't know what I leave out anymore.
Well, I'd like to ask you a question. Now, what happens if an Amish or Mennonite man says that he will not go to war and they draft him?
Well, now, I want you to understand that a lot of the things you've been reading in the paper are not, have very much to do with, our Mennonite people and our Amish people do appreciate our government. We are not trying to change that necessarily. I don't mean we think everything about it. They register, our young men do register for the draft. And we have felt that the government has been very good to them because it makes provisions for people who are really conscientiously objected to war, not as something, but they make provisions for them. Now, they must serve 2 years somewhere. Some serve in this country, some serve in other countries. I have a young friend that's just waiting now to go to Tanzania, where he'll work 2 years.
Some of the Quakers,
when there's a war, they're in the hospital. I have a son right now who's in New York working in a hospital, and then he will work 2 years. Well, that's why I've been trying to tell you. They have many bases to leave for life, but they live so differently. Well, that's the Amish people. The Amish people, there are many things that they have never accepted. I'll tell you though. They take very literally the second commandment, which says you shall not make any image of anything. I don't know how many of you are acquainted with the Ten Commandments. Some of you have learned in college. And they feel that that's an image. Now, to us, it seems to us that it would mean more of an image of worship. But they take it literally. They don't like it. All right? Let's see. We'll start here. Now I'll go up.
What are your little hats?
Oh, yes. Well, now I'm trying to tell you about everything we do. We find it in the Bible somewhere. So when you go home, you get the Bible and read it. In Corinthians, there's a chapter that tells you that women should have their head covered when they pray. Now, many people do in their churches always wear one. Some of our people take it that way, too. They wear these only when they go to church, and others wear them, well, all the time. And now, you were next. Didn't you have your hand up?
Yes. I heard that the Amish
No, they don't. Lots of Mennonites don't eat very much. I think they take that from the... I'm going to quote the Bible if you're tired of hearing it, but I have to explain how to think it. There where it says that a woman shouldn't wear that belongs to a man. Some of them that would wear them perhaps just to work, too, wouldn't wear them overdressed. All right.
Mr. Peter said that
Well, it wasn't either. In the Bible, we read that you should love your enemies and be good to them that hate you, and pray for those that despitefully use you. And so, for that reason, they feel that they can't. That's the basis for it. So in some countries, because of this position, I mean, they sometimes must suffer and be in prison. But in our country, there is provision made for them, although they don't always have, sometimes they have rather easy things to do. I mean, to that, they're safe jobs, and sometimes they're not. I don't know, did you read about Stanleyville? We had two, we had two PAX boys that were there. They were fortunate they were, I got out.
You know, the Mennonites used tractors and things like that, or did they use plows?
They use both. You go out and look at Mr. Stolzfus's barn. He's a Mennonite, and anything he has out there, a Mennonite will use. But when you get out where the Amish are, you'll see that largely they use horses. They do use some machinery, but not as much. Yeah, that is another thing. The Amish people have been very much, they have asked to be exempted from Social Security. It isn't only that they don't want to pay it, they don't want to accept it either. They have all, I told you that they are very careful to take care of their own people, and this they do. One thing I want you to look for tomorrow when you're riding around, when you see an Amish house, it'll probably be a big house, and it may, here's a big house, and out here will be a little smaller house connected to it. But there, and that's, my German isn't very good, that's a Grossdaddy house. That means that's the grandfather house. If there's a grandfather, the Amish people have no institutions like children's homes or old people's homes, because they take, if there's an orphan child, another family will take them. If the people are old, they move into the grandfather house, and there they live. And I don't know, one thing, one of the teachers was along when we sat and talked about this a while. I said, I think an old Amishman doesn't face something that many old men feel. He never faces a time when he has nothing to do unless he would be completely helpless. That would be useful. Well, he nearly always has something to do most. I mean, usually. We had a chair that needed fixing, and we went and asked for the chair shop, and they said, oh, we don't do that, but you go down here to such and such a place. And there in this Grossdaddy house lived an older Amishman. Longer could farm, but he fixed chairs, and he fixed them beautifully too. The you know, our, you may, well, do you still have your toy shop?
Yes, we'll go for that.
Well, that also is an Amishman who has one arm, but he does that. Somehow they always find something useful to do when they're old. I think part of that is the fact that they do things mainly that you do with your hands. Do you know what I mean by that? It's still able to do something, but they are good with their crafts, with their skills, and that way. Now, did I get all the hands? Oh, the Social Security, that's where I was getting to. Because of this, they take care of their people. They don't, and they don't employ too many people that aren't their own people, do they? Usually. Some do, though. But if they pay Social Security, then they would expect to, they said, well, we don't need Social Security. What do we want with it? Why should we pay it? Well, we don't want to collect it. Social Security, then, it's a completely foreign idea. Now, to people who live another, you know, mind other people having it, but they, have they given them an exemption on that?
I'm not sure how far they got this.
All right.
If they are self-employed, they don't need to pay it, so they would never collect it. If they are employed by somebody else, then they would need to pay it, because it's other people.
Well, then, I'm glad I have a lot of authorities around here, all right? Yes, they have a sort of a different pattern from what I have that you look tomorrow. And another thing that I was going to tell you is that Mennonites, many of them dress pretty simply, but they more or less adapt themselves to what other people are wearing in some ways. But an Amish person, to my, as near as I know, they've never changed any of their patterns since I know them. And you can nearly always tell them. It isn't that they wear such somber colors. Now, the Quakers, in times gone back, used to wear a gray a lot, They used to wear quiet coats. Now, this is longer than you can remember, but when they came to this country, they were known for their dress. But an Amish person, a woman, will maybe wear a dark dress, but she will wear a bright colored apron. And they never wear colored flowers. They never wear figures or flowers or designs, all the same colors. They wear blue. They have several colors. They wear blue and lavender.
No. Bruce?
And green. Those and pink. Those four colors they will wear. They never wear yellow, though. I don't know why, but I know they don't. I'm seeing they wear the primary colors, some. And
Bruce?
Little girls have colored sunbonnets.
Are the Amish people very brave?
Well, I think they're pretty brave. Some man said to the Mennonites one time, yes, you're brave. But an Amishman is brave, he'll come to town with his beard. Now, that was before everybody else was wearing a beard. But he said that you can always tell an Amishman. Now, the Amishmen do wear beards after they are married. A single man will not wear a beard, but after they're married, they wear a beard.
In the paper the other day, there was this article about, I think it was Levi Stolfer's, and he had a horse or something that he trained for a race, you know, a horse race or something. And I think he was might have been Amish because he had a big beard and a broad-brimmed hat.
Was he? Was one of your Amish?
He came to Yonkers. There was a sale of racing horses, and he was there at the sale.
Oh, well, I wonder if that isn't from up at Leola.
They go to those places and buy horses
that are
bunch of good, and
they bring them with yourself. And we have a horse auction around here. Another thing I want to tell you, if you notice it, when I went by Leola Post Office today, I thought, now here's one for the tourists. There's a sign right there, hitching posts in the back for our carriage trade. Now, you don't have a sign like that in front of your post office, do you? So I think you're going to find this very interesting, and as you all right.
What would happen if an Amish person became very ill and went to a hospital, and in terms of maybe a heart attack?
It's medical aid or something like that, they will accept it. That's what I said. It's very hard for even them to know how to draw the line, I think. All right.
I've been told that Amish don't ride machines. Does this include simple machines?
Well, that's what we were... how simple a machine do you mean? They don't like cameras very good, but that's... Yes, those kind they would accept. And they also have water wheels, and maybe you'll see one. Well, they see
one today.
Well, now, those are Amish shoes. They build them themselves. And there's one very complicated that we go to see sometimes. It provides water for about three farms. Now, those things, they don't call that a machine, although you know that is a simple machine. But it's the more complicated machines that they... now, they also use steam engines, don't they know? Steam engines.
Oh, really?
Steam engines are very good with them. We have the old threshers. But it's I can't tell you how they draw the line, but I'm just telling you where they draw it.
Going to make a pump's water.
Yeah, we'll see that. Now, this is not a big water wheel like the one at Hopewell Village. It's just a small one.
They're just small ones. They work, you'll see them. You'll see this thing in the meadow. You should point them out to
we them. Will. We'll go out there. Mary?
Yeah. Will they travel by a
They use buses and trains, but I don't know about planes.
Would you explain a little bit further what would happen when they shun somebody, when somebody does something that, say, an Amish person would do something that was against his religion?
He would leave his group entirely after having been a member of it. Well, this is what would happen if this person, they would not eat with them. There's a verse in the Bible that says, with such and one you ought not to eat. Now, in our own church, in the Mennonite church, we feel this means you should not eat the communion with them. But they take it that this means you should not eat it all with them. you're gonna hear a lot of fine points.
Suppose in one of you in the group, the rest decided that they wouldn't eat with you, they wouldn't sit down with you, they wouldn't talk with you, they would have absolutely nothing to do with you. That's the way you might feel if you're an Amish person and this happened to you.
Do you have it moved? I think that is there somewhere. But because this particular passage is in that part of the Bible that's speaking about the communion, most of us feel this means.
Oh, I hear it is. Well, it's not to do not to keep company with any man that is calling brothers in the point of view or covetous or idolatrous or a railer or a drunkard with such a one, you're not to keep. That's where they.
And they take up very literally to even eat a meal with them. Now, I don't want you to blame this on that, right? Because that was one of the points of departure between these two groups long ago. And I think many other things that seem so different among us now were perhaps more alike then, the way they dress and so on. But the Amish have not changed their ways any more than they could help it from the time they came to this country. They've had to change it some. Because I don't even suppose they brought a carriage with them when they came. Did someone have a hand up? They wanted to ask something?
Freddie, I think.
Yes, I think I have that data. They began coming here before 1700.
Now, could you tell us about how many generations of that would be? That is, fathers, grandfathers, and...
I used to know how many generations I was here since my own... my name is Eve. I'm married to a girl, so I've got kind of out of this German circle. But the Edies came here. How many? Do you know how many generations it would be back from then?
Mm-hmm.
My mother, my father, my grandfather would go back to, I would say 6 or 7, but maybe I'm something like that, depending upon 7 or 8. Because I know that for myself it isn't as many as for some people, because my mother was 45 and I was born, and her mother was 45 and she was born, so you see I kind of lost a generation in there, some other people have. But it's quite a long time, and we have homes, we have farms that people still live on whose fathers 7 generations ago got their first deeds from the sons of William Penn. I think the ones around Lancaster were mostly signed by the sons of William Penn and not the William Penn himself. But there are people who live in our neighborhood who have been able to keep their homesteads in this one name for all these generations. And they look back then, there are others, of course, who haven't been. Now, not all men, I wanted to tell you something else, too. Some people think that all the Mennonites in the world live right in this section. There are Mennonites in many states of the Union. There are Mennonites in some cities. We have some Mennonites even who live in New York. But not in those large groups. You'll find them, they're rural people to begin with, and they do not take so easily to the city. But some of them do.
Is there some in the city? Are there many Mennonite churches in the
city? Only small. In some cities there are, but in New York you will only find small ones, more like the storefront churches.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that they could go on asking questions for another hour.
I wanted
but
to
I
tell
them
they were geographically,
sort of
they were geographically, I wanted you to know that there are Mennonites in Canada, and in most of the states of the Union. There are still Mennonites in Holland, there are still Mennonites in Switzerland, there are still Mennonites in Germany. And there were many Mennonites at one time in Russia. They went there not too long after the ones came to America. But most of those have left Germany, have left Russia, because they weren't very welcome there after the revolution, as you can guess.
And in South America, aren't there a lot in South America,
yes,
too?
Yes, and many of these who left Russia were settled in South America, and just in within my, I can remember them going there. So that is the latest Mennonite settlement.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to stop now. Thank you very much. I think everybody was very interested. And now Mrs. Hess is going to talk to you about some other aspects of the Pennsylvania Dutch.
Die
fished. He gave. This is a friendly greeting that the Pennsylvania Dutch people use, but actually there aren't too many people in Lancaster County or in this whole area that speak the Pennsylvania Dutch language anymore.
Could we learn those two? What was the first one?
Be bished. And the other one is be gate.
And what does the first one mean?
How are you? Or how does it go with you? How are you? Would be the way we would say. In other words, when you say hello to somebody, you say, well, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
And so they would say, be bitch or be gay. There are Amish people living in 60 different sections of the United States and Canada. They're not all here in this area of Pennsylvania, but in 60 different sections of the United States and Canada. And they all speak the Pennsylvania Dutch language. Now, the Pennsylvania Dutch language is a dialect between, it's a folk speech. It's a mixture of Swiss and German and a little English. It's similar to the Lapdeutsch that was spoken in southern Germany. And today, most of the Mennonites and other people who came from this area have forgotten the Pennsylvania Dutch language. It doesn't take long to forget it if you don't use it. My father, for instance, spoke Pennsylvania Dutch in his home and couldn't even speak English at all until he went to school. But he never taught it to any of his children. He liked the idea of having them learn English, and this was true of most of the Mennonites. And so most of the people that are Pennsylvania Dutch have lost this folk speech, except the Amish. And they don't like, as Mrs. Glass told you, they don't like much change. Their general attitude, what was good enough for Grandpa is good enough for me. And so they still use the Pennsylvania Dutch language, but most of the rest of us have lost it. I said it's a folk speech, it's a dialect between German and English, and yet there is so much likeness to this speech, no matter whether you are in Pennsylvania, among the Pennsylvania Dutch, or in Ohio, or Indiana, or any of the other several sections where you find the German people, or the Amish people. There is only enough difference to make it interesting, that they can understand each other. And this is different from other countries. In Europe, for instance, you can drive 10 miles away from the area in which someone lives in Europe, and you can't understand them at all because they use a different language. But the Pennsylvania Dutch language is so similar that they can easily understand. Today I had a group out on tour, and there was one boy from Germany. He was from northern Germany, and so this Pennsylvania Dutch language was new to him. It was very difficult for him to understand. We had a little Amish boy get on the bus and talk to us in Pennsylvania Dutch, and this German boy couldn't understand it because it was a different language. So the Pennsylvania Dutch isn't the same as the German that is used in Germany today. But it's a lot of people think it's just a corrupt form of German, but it seems to be a speech of its own, a folk speech. And it was never written. It was never a written language, just a folk speech, until very recently. Now, several colleges, and in one of our own Mennonite colleges, this course can be studied to learn the Pennsylvania Dutch language. Some of the expressions that the Pennsylvania Dutchman uses then would be mixed with the German. So when we speak Pennsylvania or when we speak English in this area, sometimes we stick a German word in it, or a Pennsylvania Dutch word. So when the Dutchman wants to water the lawn, or sprinkle the lawn, he said he spritzes the grass. When he gets up in the morning and looks in the mirror, he sees his hair isn't very well combed, and so he'll say, it's just plain scribbly. And in church services, their services are very long, and sometimes the children become a little bit restless and don't want to sit quietly. Well, Dad will reprimand a little boy sitting next to him and try to get him to be quiet, and doing this, he'll say, stop rooching. Of course, on the other hand, Dad's a good disciplinarian, and sometimes if he still wants to rooch around, in other words, doesn't want to sit still, Daddy will take him outside and find a woodshed. Could you guess what he takes him out there for? What?
He gives him a whooping.
Yes, he gives him a whooping.
And I guess they say like a whooping.
A spanking. So when he, because he doesn't behave in church, he should be very quiet when he's sitting in church. And if he doesn't sit quietly, then Dad will tell him to stop rooching. But if he still doesn't sit quietly, then he'll take him out and find a woodshed. Then when they come back, he's ready to sit.
Well, when we come back, we'll try that cure for rooching and see if it works.
I don't think so. He'd be ready to stay.
Well, you know, the Amish children have a lot of respect for their parents. They have a lot of respect for their ministers or their church. They have a lot of respect for their teachers or whoever is in authority. They have been taught by their parents from little up that they are supposed to behave and obey their parents or whoever is in authority. Yes.
Well, I don't think they can sit down after by taking
the
woodshed.
Very good. Well, they sit very softly. They don't flop down in it. When the potato bin is empty, the housewife says, oh, the potatoes are off. She doesn't say they're all gone. To rent out a closet is to put it in order. Be out in the light. Or make the light out.
Hey, just bet on the opposite. Just the opposite sometimes. Or some of the words will make when they can be backwards.
Backwards because the German language is different. You see, and so the verb is placed at a different place, and so they mix some of this German with their English, and that's why they're all back.
And it don't matter, you don't have to be able to talk sense to make it does. You just use it like this.
Sometimes the foods that the Pennsylvania Dutch eat are wonderful good, like our supper tonight. Wonderful good. Do you know what apple dumplings are?
Yes.
Well, the Pennsylvania Dutch people make a meal with of apple dumplings. That means, I mean, this is another expression that we use, make a meal of this. They use this apple dumpling as their main course. And that is practically all that they have. That is the main dish of the meal. And my grandmother's steam pudding was a treat that no one else could match. And my sister-in-law wrote a couple of gathering these old Pennsylvania Dutch recipes together. And so she wanted this recipe of my grandmother's steamed.